Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Rory, Jack Spencer, Jacob Kanzler, and our special guest this week, Andrea Bightley. We're going to have Ari Adler a little later, but first, guys, let's talk about, we've already had a busy first week, and the legislature hasn't even come in yet. Gretchen Whitmer, Dana Nessel coming in already with making news left and right. First thing that I want to talk about, though, why is Dana Nessel asking Kim Worthy's opinion on the Flint water crisis? Jack, what was your first thought on that?
Well, my first thought on all of these things is I don't think they're random or done off the cuff. I think they're well prepared, and they probably have discussed these things ahead of time. Now, where this is going to go, I think that's where it's an interesting thing to try to guess at. Are they going to try to come down at some point and say, look, what the previous administration did on this was wrong as far as the prosecutions? Is it going to be simply the fact that they want to get their feet on the ground and have a long-term plan where they can say, we're trying to address this, and then sort of be watching what the courts do in the meantime? In other words, is this going to last a year?
It could last a year, John, but I don't think it's going to last that long. Is this just about getting a second opinion?
I think it's about taking the politics out of it. I mean, there were a lot of people in town who thought Attorney General Bill Schuette was using it as a political tool in terms of the Nick Lyon and the Eden Wells prosecution, whether they were true or not. I'm not saying they were, but I think this way you're saying, all right, here's a prosecutor out of Detroit who can look at it and say whether or not it should proceed, and then you're kind of taking the politics out of the hands of the Attorney General, and you're saying, yeah, this is either good, we're going to continue to go forward with it, and she'll do it, or somebody else will do it, or it's bad, and we're going to, you know, back out of it.
So we have Andrea Bightley here, former Attorney General spokesperson, and now that you've heard what we had to say, now you got to try and prove us wrong. Are we wrong?
So I think there's an interesting dynamic here. AG Nessel had to pick which side of the conflict wall she was going to come into. She could pick to be on the state side, defending the state of Michigan from the lawsuits filed by Flint residents, or she could be on the prosecution side where Attorney General Schuette was. Having Prosecutor Worthy come in and review the charges and potentially take on the case, from what I've read, is a possibility. It allows Attorney General Nessel to stay the course a little bit and evaluate both sides of the situation.
So you mean as Attorney General, you can't be on both sides of the conflict wall is what you're saying. So she is now leaving her options open as to what side of the conflict wall she's going to be on.
She is. So while Attorney General Schuette was in office, he chose to pursue the prosecution side, leaving 97% of the office on the state defense side. So Attorney General Nessel has to make a decision. She may have already done so. And she could pick prosecution or state defense. And being the state defense side allows her to settle with the victims of the Flint water crisis. Being on the prosecution side would allow her to determine whether or not charges against Nick Lyon, Eden Wells, and several others move forward.
I would think if I'm Todd Flood, I'm packing up my office. Should I be?
Todd has known Attorney General Nessel for a long time. He knows Prosecutor Worthy. I think that's a discussion that he'll need to have with the new Attorney General and with Prosecutor Worthy potentially down the road. If Prosecutor Worthy evaluates the cases and says, I think he's right or I think he's wrong, he is still the attorney of record on the case. And so a judge in Genesee County would have to remove Todd from the case. He would have to file a motion, but a judge would have to say, I grant your motion and you're no longer on the case.
Another thing that Dana Nessel is tackling right out of the chute, Jacob, is this issue about whether the tunnel agreement that the legislature and Governor Snyder reached before he left office is valid. What do you think she's going to end up doing on this? Is she going to say that that tunnel agreement was good to go?
Well, the way the rollout went on Wednesday, which leads you to believe that the Attorney General already has an opinion wrapped up and ready to go. But we discussed earlier that maybe this is Governor Whitmer and AG Nessel kind of playing their part and saying, we vetted this. We looked into this when it wasn't looked into during the legislative session that was during lame duck. And we found that, you know, we can't really find a case against it. So that is a possibility, but you would think the way it rolled out that I think the opinions and stance is already there.
So you think that they're going to say there's problems?
Yeah, I think there's very likely that they will find a case for it to be unconstitutional. I mean, there were six questions on them, and some of them were very open-ended.
Jack, what do you think? Is there any chance that Dana Nessel comes back and says, God, you know what? Rick Snyder and the legislature did a great job. There's nothing we can do, guys. Sorry.
No, they'll find something wrong with it. Maybe a lot of things, maybe not a lot of things. But what I think is interesting in both of these cases, they do have the similarity where they're both issues where the Democrats have said an awful lot of things and made an awful lot of very strong, taken very strong opinions. And it's maybe a way of inoculating them against, you know, what may be coming down or what or how they think these things can be actually solved. So is there a way that Dana Nessel and the governor can still remain having their position on Flint water, having the same position they have on the tunnel, while and not being blamed when both those problems take a different route through the court?
What do you think, Andrea? Any chance that Dana Nessel comes back and says, this is good to go?
Well, one of the campaign promises I believe she made was that Line 5 was out on day one.
Yeah.
Now, Governor Whitmer was a little more not 100% committed to removing on day one. I believe she said she would look at it and determine when she was in office what she would do. Now, the interesting thing about asking for an AG opinion is that an AG opinion isn't supposed to take into account politics. An AG opinion is strictly a reading of state law. So if there's something on the books that allows this, then there's something on the books that allows it. If there isn't, then there isn't.
So
and that's
this
the
gives
way
her
it works.
Political cover.
It does, in a way. It does. So if MCL 750.52 allows for a decision like this to be made by the legislature and by the governor, then...
No, your team looked at this issue a lot, didn't
they? We did.
Well, one of the things that I wonder about, if you stop this all of a sudden, if Nessel and Whitmer stop this, or issue an opinion that's adverse to that authority, don't you run the risk of wind up leaving that pipeline running under the water as this goes through the courts longer than it would if you just went through with this deal?
Yeah, I believe you could. If the state of Michigan were to sue Enbridge and pursue long-term complex litigation against Enbridge, a judge would have to turn off the pipeline. And it would be a very difficult decision for a judge, especially a judge in northern Michigan, to turn off a pipeline that, one, is jobs for northern Michigan and the oil and gas industry, and two, the propane. I don't know if any of you spend much time in the UP or if any of the listeners do, but what do you see dotted along the countryside in the Upper Peninsula? Propane tanks. And propane moves through Line 5.
But imagine that. Imagine that, though, if they delayed it for 6 or 7 or 8 years beyond what the horizon of this tunnel would have been, and something happens.
Yep.
I mean, the environmentalists are all for this challenge, but I'm not sure they've really thought through what could really happen down the line.
It could be counterproductive.
From a dollar perspective, when you think about the dollar value of what's going through that pipeline, Enbridge can afford to string this along in litigation for years and years and years to come.
And in the end, the judge could find that the state of Michigan has to reimburse Enbridge's court costs, which if they hire a $1,000 an hour attorney, the cost is huge for the taxpayers.
I'm more cynical than you are. I think it has less to do with the practicality part is I think they know there are practical aspects of both these issues that we've talked about. Okay, now we're not running anymore. Now we have to deal with the practicality of it. We can't let people a quarter of a million people freeze in the Upper Peninsula. So you have to have a way of dealing with it practically, which it may take quite a while probably, at the same time giving cover, particularly for Nessel, political cover, where she can still say, I haven't changed my position on this, I still think this and this and this. However, we've got to have it go through courts or whatever, however they end up working it out.
Well, we'll see how this one plays out. One person that we haven't talked about yet, a new statewide official, Garland Gilchrest, is going to start this week in the Senate. Bang the gavel, get things started. They've already had to make the adjustments on the podium in the Senate chamber so he's not staring into a bright light when he's looking at the Senate Majority Floor Leader. So here's the question, guys. What role does he play in the Governor Whitmer administration? And I put this out there because he has no legislative experience. He's never served in elected politics before. His background is being in the technology industry. So I wonder if Governor Whitmer doesn't end up putting him into some kind of role where he is the fix-it person for computer issues, if you will, Jacob. And there's been plenty of them in DHHS. I mean, you can't go around state government and can't find some type of issues that's gone on. That's what he did in the city of Detroit.
Yeah, I mean, IT is always a challenge for state government as they constantly are trying to upgrade from legacy systems. And so I know you had some time with him, and that has he has some experience with the city of Detroit. And so you could see them him assisting or advising that role could be a productive way for him to be LT.
Do you really want somebody in charge like that over an area that could really go wrong at some point in time?
Imagine if Brian Kelly would have been in charge of the UIA computer system.
But Brian Kelly's experience wasn't in the UIA computer system, but I see what you're going.
Had it been, and you know, I mean, the same, bad things can happen with these large, complex computer operations. We've
all
seen it.
Well, my argument is, though, is if Governor Whitmer is going to keep DHHS together, and the idea is to try and get services to individuals and try and merge those two systems together, what better answer would be then to take somebody who could be making a lot more than he's making right now as LG out in the West Coast if you really wanted to, and put him in a position where he can try and coordinate these computer systems together, get him out of the public spotlight for a year or so while he gets used to being in that job, so he's not left to kind of flounder on an island banging the gavel every 3 days of the week over in the Senate. I mean, that's not where his skill set is. I could see him getting bored very quickly doing what he's doing, reciting off a script and speaking on procedural motions.
The Senate majority has tightened significantly, and if one or two of the Senate Republicans move over and vote with the Dems, you know, Garland could actually play a pretty busy, important role. Gretchen Whitmer is very experienced in the legislature, and I can't imagine her pseudo-abandoning the Senate.
Well,
I'm not saying that. Yeah.
Well, I'm saying he's still there when they know that there's going to be some tough votes. I mean, it's not like he's going to just say, sayonara, I'm not going to see you again. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, presiding over the Senate, and Jack, you're doing that right now. I mean, that's an hour a day.
Well, I think what you're saying is that's not something that's going to take massive amount of study in terms of knowing that I'm the yes vote on this thing that the governor wants, and
right.
and I'm the one that breaks the tie and the staff to kind of do the negotiating. And I don't know. On the computer stuff, I just think there's a problem with something that I really question how much anybody, no matter how smart they are, can really control the potential major problems that can show up, as we saw before with the unemployment situation. Maybe he could come out, take a good look at it, study it for 6 months, and come back and say what a mess the former governor left it in, or something along those lines. And gee whiz, you know, if we're in danger of having this new thing on Medicaid where people get kicked off, they're going to make the same kind of mistakes there that they made with the other. I could see him being useful in all kinds of things like that.
Well, I just see him as being a unique talent that we haven't had in that office before, and it would be a waste to not utilize those talents in some way.
The webmaster of the state.
Ooh, webmaster for the state.
I mean, it's hard to make, you know, I mean, you've got support there, and it's all about thinking through it and making a nice user-friendly one-stop shop portal, right? Isn't that what they always talk about?
I'd be, as I'm thinking about this, I'd be surprised as you look at his career trajectory that he wouldn't go out and seek these opportunities himself. I don't think he would necessarily be handed a project. I'm sure he's going to find something that he can put his own name on.
Well, but he's not going to go solo. It's not like he's going to go renegade and tell Whitmer, hey, I'm going to do this. I mean, Whitmer is going to give him tasks, I got to imagine.
The governor hopes not.
Garland Goldcrest goes renegade.
I think what I'm suggesting is he may be actually overqualified in some areas
for what
you really want someone in that position to do.
And that's why I say you give him a complex task, and so that challenges him, and that way he doesn't step on you or you don't step on him while you're trying to do what you need to do in the legislature, which Whitmer is more than capable, and that's really where his strength is.
He also keep him too busy to talk to the press too much.
And there you go. And to overshadow Governor Whitmer.
But who would want to avoid talking to us?
Nobody should be afraid of us.
You guys were the best part of the last 4 years of my life.
Yay! That's what we like to hear. That's what we like to hear. Okay, bold prediction of the day. I'm going to say that the legislature is going to accomplish the no-fault issue in this term, that they will pass some type of no-fault reform. Now, I'm not going to say that it's comprehensive. I'm not going to say that it's going to be the greatest no-fault package ever. But I do believe that the House and the Senate and Governor Whitmer will sign some type of reform to the auto no-fault insurance that is going to be advertised as lowering rates.
Is it the Duggan plan?
I don't know if it would be the Duggan plan or not, but it will encompass some type of compromise where we'll have more transparency on the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Association, probably limit what kind of discounts the insurance companies can offer as part of where you live by zip code or whatever.
So you're not specifying whether this is just going to be window dressing or whether it's going to be a comprehensive solution.
I'm saying that they were going to do something that they will advertise as this will cut down on rates.
Sort of like the last roads package was supposed to fix the roads?
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. The same kind of thing. Again, did it really fix the roads or not? I mean, I think that's subject to debate, but that there will be something. And let me give you my reasons why. First of all, we've got new leadership in the House and the Senate that does not have some kind of cloud of immediate politics going on them. Particular Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky has a reputation of being able to get in and actually fix things and get things done, like the Healthy Michigan Plan, which he didn't like initially, but he was able to craft something that got Republicans on board, something they normally would not have gotten on board with. Also, you have some 40, 50 new legislators, both the House and the Senate, coming in who are not beholden to any kind of special interest and are coming in fresh, off a campaign trail where they heard from their own constituents, we want this addressed immediately. So they are coming with that background, and they're not coming in beholden to this person or that person or that interest or that interest. They only want to get something done so they can go back and say, we actually got something done. Anyone want to prove me wrong or say no?
I think they'll pass something, but I think it's more likely to be a window dressing bill than a true solution.
I don't buy the coming in fresh concept at all. They've all talked about it enough with their constituents. The ones who like catastrophic claims and the whole thing have taken that classic view on that's not the problem. We need to do this. We need those darn insurance companies to stop cheating us. The other ones have had their argument. We got to get rid of the catastrophic claims. The problem with this issue, I've always felt, is this is one where everybody has their pet plan on how you do it. And I'm not so sure just because these are new people that they haven't already said things that have kind of put them in a corner.
So you're taking the cynical approach here that since that the same problems that have plagued the no-fault argument in the past are going to come back again. It's just going to be new faces on the old problem.
It'll be the same. Now, that doesn't say that you can't do something that's window dressing. That doesn't say you can't do something. I've always felt that because everyone has their own ideas on this, the mistake is to try to do it all at once. So if you can do incrementally this, then maybe over the course of the next 20 years you can get a lot of it solved. But as far as doing something that really has people out there going, holy cow, my bill's back down the way it is in other states, I find that very hard to believe.
I think the problem is the tiered structure thing, Andrea. If once you start chipping away at that, that's where I think you get into problems. But if you put rate caps on caretaker coverage, for instance, and you put some type of fee schedule on the hospitals, and then do some of the things I said earlier about the Catastrophic Claims Association and limits on the insurance company and what kind of rebates they give, I think you can get somewhere.
I think it could be a window dressing thing, and I also think you still have a money problem because Democrats are going to get money from trial attorneys. The Republicans and the Democrats are getting money from the hospitals, from the insurance companies, and they're hearing from their own constituents about, my dad had a terrible car accident, and $1 million later, he's better, but the insurance company paid for it. Mm-hmm. As someone who's lived out of state, I can tell you that our car insurance in Virginia was quarterly what we're paying monthly here in Michigan, and we don't drive expensive cars. It was a pretty big eye-opener just to see the incredible cost. And Virginia is a very populated state. We lived near D.C., so we were in heavy traffic constantly. And quarterly payments in Virginia were the same as monthly in Michigan.
And that's why I'm saying. I mean, everybody knows we have the highest car insurance mm-hmm. rates in the country. And I think now the political will to get this done is going to reach a crescendo this year, because if they go back in 2 years to their constituents and try and get reelected, they have to say they did something. And maybe it is window dressing, John. I'm just saying that they have to do something, and something will get done. Whether it's window dressing, we'll find out. Okay, last thing. God, this podcast is as long as a motherfucker. I don't understand why. We should just start bleeping all that out. Does this?
It's because we all talk too much.
The longer you talk, the more likely you're going to say something like
"motherfucker," and
I don't understand why. What did you think of when she said that?
Well, my question is: does that make Congresswoman Tlaib automatically a presidential candidate?
Ooh, that could very well be.
She sure got national attention. I believe the president responded to it. So now she's on the radar from coast to coast.
She was on the radar before this, but she was really on the radar on Friday.
Well, and unlike the new congresswoman from New York, she's old enough. So she could actually qualify because she's over the age of 35.
Yeah, I think that this is definitely the first move in something far, far more ambitious.
She's gotten more publicity than any other freshman, I think.
By far. And honestly, I would have never advised her to say something like that. However, I think she made the right call. Don't take it back.
Just keep going forward.
If you take it back, then your base starts to doubt you and your bona fides. So she keeps going, and she's going to say what she's going to say. And I think her comments about, I'm a girl from Detroit resonates at least around here.
And I don't think her district's going to punish her for it.
No, absolutely not. Her district's probably going to like her even more for it.
Let's find out if there's any other thing we can bleep out of here. If not, this is my first time just trying to bleep. Okay.
What the You better bleep this out.
All right, let's bring Ari Adler in here.
She knows the one thing that she seems to want to have most, and you chose to save yourself in your own time. You'll have to stay and open up your own.
Joining us in MERS World Headquarters is Ari Adler, who went out the door with Governor Snyder, you in a box, and maybe the moving crew. Is there anybody else left there by the time you and the governor left, Ari?
I think we were the definition of a skeleton crew by the time we were done.
Right?
I mean, it was good. We had a lot of people who found opportunities and other things and had a chance to go elsewhere. So I know it was down to just two of us in the communications office, two and a half basically. And then we ended up trying to keep up with all of the bills and the announcements and everything as best we could.
So Governor Snyder's executive office typically had how many people, and then how many were left by the time it was all over?
Oh, I mean, we had probably 50 people at its peak. I know in the Office of Communications, we always ran a lean shop, but we probably had a dozen people at its max. And by the time we were done, we were down to just the basically two and a half to three of us.
Jeez. And then what about the rest of the staff? 50 was the peak he left office with.
We probably had a dozen people left.
Okay.
Enough to kind of represent each division. But it was, people had opportunities and they took them, and we just held on as best we could.
So tell me about what that last week was like with just this flood of bills coming in for the governor to go through. I mean, we were talking like some 400 bills with a skeleton crew like that. How did you guys vet through those bills, and then the whole process of putting together all the press releases you guys did for those days? Talk to us about how that all went down.
Probably the best way to describe it is managed chaos. I mean, there is a lot of activity going on when you have that many bills coming in, but it is an opportunity when having a nerd for a boss really shined. I mean, and he's always done this. He would keep track of things on spreadsheets. And so we would all have access to a spreadsheet that basically told us, here's the bill number, here's the sponsor, here's essentially what it does, a quick one-liner about it, what its current status is, if it's approved for signature, if he has questions. There's a lot of different activities you can look at on that spreadsheet, and it allows us to just kind of keep track of everything as it's moving through.
So how far in advance then, I'm curious now that you can talk about this, how far in advance did he know whether or not he was going to sign something?
Sounds like he pretty much had his analysis going on quite a ways back.
There was analysis going on as soon as the bills came over. And, when we say, he'll make a decision when he sees the final version, that was true. I mean, we would always wait until we saw what it actually looked like when it came out of the legislature. But then he would start to go through things, and as he would read through them and go through the analysis, he could make some decisions pretty quickly, whether he liked something or not, or if he had questions and was kind of leaning one way or the other and wanted more information, then that would be provided for him. But we tried to stay on top of it, so we knew in the communications office if he was, giving a green light to something, we knew it was going to to be signed. Sometimes it's just a question of timing. There's the logistics of actually getting him the bills, getting him signed, getting him filed. And then we ended up plugging him into press releases. And you guys are aware at the end there, we were dumping a lot into press releases all at once because we got into a bind at the end where we had a lot stacked up.
Well, I was thinking of these 42 bills that he ended up vetoing him. I mean, these were all very well done letters. I mean, this wasn't just a sentence or two scratched on letterhead. Some of these bills were very well analyzed as far as his reasoning for vetoing them. These had to be crafted in advance.
They were not crafted very far in advance. I mean, there is an opportunity when he has questions on a bill and he's thinking, well, I don't know if I'm going to sign it or I'm going to veto it. Then as a team, we would look at it and say, all right, we have 50-50 chance, right? We have two options here. He's going to sign it or he's going to veto it. So we would prepare for that. We would have statements that we would start working on from the communication shop. Our legal team would look at, if we were going to do a veto letter, what would be in that? So you try to get ahead as best you can so that when the final decision is made, you're ready and you can make that announcement.
I was just surprised that you guys were done on that Friday and you didn't take to Saturday and the Sunday and New Year's Eve. I was almost certain that I was going to be working New Year's Eve.
Well, we were too. I mean, early on, and I was even quoted, I think, saying we're probably going to go into the weekend because we just didn't know if we'd be able to keep up with the influx of bills that were being processed. But we reached a point where we kind of looked at what was left. The governor looked at it and said, you know, if we stayed late on the Friday, we could probably get done tonight and then people wouldn't have to work into the weekend and into the holiday. And most of the staff was good with that. I talked to a few reporters. They were like, you know what, we'll stick around, give us what you've got, and then we don't have to cover it on the weekend. So I think most people were pretty happy about that.
Was there anything that he vetoed that surprised you?
I was more surprised at some of their reactions to the vetoes. Some of the media in particular really went out and did headlines and bigger stories on the fact that he vetoed some of the online gambling and that kind of stuff. To me, that was a surprise. I didn't expect that from Governor Snyder. I mean, he's never been a big proponent of expanding gambling in the state. So that didn't really surprise me, but the reaction to that surprised me. I thought that got more attention than it would have.
And then what about the baby box? I guess that was the one that surprised me because it seemed like kind of an innocuous change. They've done it in other states. You know, you put the baby in the box in the fire station. I guess that one was the one that surprised me, not you?
No, I don't think so. I think it, you know, really was a situation where he looked at, are you completely sort of removing the human connection there of, we have the law in Michigan where you can anonymously drop off a baby, right? But you have to give them to someone as opposed to just this idea of putting them in a box, I think was just, he wasn't comfortable with it and decided the right thing to do was to veto it.
Kind of like a library book, you put it in the slot, or a movie, you know, if people still return movies to Family Video.
Yeah, it was, I mean, it was just sort of that concept. And, you know, we had a lot of outreach from people. I mean, we've seen it done in other states, but we had people reach out to our office and say that it wasn't a good idea. And so we took a careful look at it. And the governor, you know, he takes a good look at everything and makes a decision based on all of the input. We learned, and I learned early on, you give him the input, he is going to review it, and then he's going to make a decision. And that's the decision he sticks with.
Was there a lot of debate going on around the changes pertaining to petitions and capping the number of petition signatures at 15% per?
When it came to those petitions, when it came to anything that came up with the proposals, he looked at all of those bills right away from the standpoint of, if he were going to be continuing as governor, how would he have felt about it? So he kind of removed, there was the whole debate about it was, you know, Republicans trying to do a power grab and it was the politics behind everything. He looked at it from a policy standpoint and what was good for Michigan and what was his position. If he had been continuing as governor, would he have appreciated or not appreciated having that law in place? And that's what he did when he looked at all of these different policy decisions.
You know, the bill that got a lot of publicity during the lame duck period were the bills that didn't get to the governor. The new elections commission that had been proposed that was going to take over campaign finance matters, and that never got to the House. Did the governor send a signal at some point and say, you know what, that's not really anything I'm interested in?
No, I mean, we looked at everything that might be coming over to us, and, you know, the governor had opinions on things, and he may have shared those with leadership. I wasn't in those meetings, but I think that was more of a disconnect between Senate and House and what they were trying to do than anything that our office did on it.
Snyder wasn't going to sign that bill, was he?
I don't know, because we never saw the final version.
Well, what was the notes on the spreadsheet? It couldn't have been positive.
Well, those weren't on the spreadsheet because the bills never came to us. So when I talk about having bills on the spreadsheet, it's bills that once we receive them, they start getting entered into the spreadsheet and we take a look at them.
Surely you had a feeling where he was going. This was a taking away of authority from the executive branch, which kind of falls within one of his criteria for vetoing bills.
Well, and I think that's, again, where he would have looked at it from the standpoint of, if he were continuing to be governor, would he have appreciated that law being there or not? And that's how he would have voted, he would have decided whether to veto or to sign it.
Do you think the public statements and maybe even some private statements that were made by incoming Governor-elect Whitmer and Dana Nessel impacted his thinking about some of these bills that might have changed sort of the parameters of how they had to govern under?
I mean, I think he always took input from everybody, and he and Governor-elect at the time, Whitmer, had some good conversations and a number of meetings about transition. But I think it really came down to looking at the branches of government, separation of powers, how things should be handled, and that's what he made his decision based on.
One of the things that's always kind of surprised me about him, or has left a mark with me anyway, is how when the public opinion gets really high and he faces a lot of criticism, how he dials that out, and it almost kind of pushes back against that kind of stuff and does his own thing. He is a guy who just does not like to be bullied.
He does not like that. And, you know, he has been quoted as saying that if you want to convince somebody to come to your side or share your opinion, you know, what's the best way to do it? Do you sit down and reason with them and give them information and help change their mind? Or do you stand and yell at them, you know, and shout things at them that don't make any sense? And so that's where he's always been on that. And it's, you know, if you want to have a good dialogue and a discussion, I mean, one of his big things that he's going to continue to push is the idea of civility, particularly in politics. And so that's going to make a better headway if you can do something and have a civil discourse and a discussion with somebody.
So for our listeners' background, just so they remember, you ended your tenure with Snyder as his press secretary, but that's not where you started.
No, I started with the governor as a special projects manager.
What year?
That would have been in early 2015. So I ended my term with Speaker of the House Jace Bolger at the time. I was his director of communications. And then I came over to the governor's office, and I was special projects manager for about a year. And then they asked me to step up as director in February of 16.
Now, you've done comms now in the House. You've done comms in the Senate for the majority leader. You've done comms in the governor's office. Which was better?
Yeah, I've done communications for a State Department too. I've kind of run the gamut
MDOT.
Here. Yeah, I was over at MDOT for a number of years. Which was better? They all had their good days and bad days. I will say that I never realized how busy a governor's office is until you get inside. We had busy days when I was in the legislature, both in the House and the Senate, but there are sort of prescribed downtime days, right, in the legislature because of the schedule. But the governor's office never stops. And you end up having to react to things, not just with the policy, but also everything that's going on statewide, everything that's going on nationally. A lot of times you have to make some sort of a comment or something, or you have to react to it. And so it's just a nonstop job that you're doing. And, you know, I worked for a governor who never stopped. I mean, his whole mantra of working in dog years, we were doing that right up until the end. And that's how he's always looked at, how do you get things done? And then you get something done. And he was never a big one for a victory lap. It was more like, okay, that's great, we got it done. Let's move on to the next thing on the to-do list.
So in that regard, he was different from Bolger or Ken Sikkema.
Well, I mean, I don't think they were necessarily in it for the credit either, but it was more of sort of the idea of a governor's office just being a nonstop situation, whereas the legislature sort of has starts and stops because of the calendar that they keep.
How do you think you're going to remember your time in the governor's office?
I'm going to remember being tired a lot.
A high-energy guy anyway.
I am a high-energy guy, but put a tweet out to Zach Pohl, who's the new director of communications for Governor Whitmer, and I told him congratulations, and I said my best advice to him was to get a sponsor for an energy drink that he likes right away, because it adds up on the salary after a while when you start buying those things because they're expensive. But it's, you know, it's one of those things where you have a lot to do. You have a lot to keep track of. You kind of always have to be on top of everything that's happening, every little detail of things, as much as you can. And it's exhausting after a while.
You know, we think of our Capitol Press Corps, but it's always more than just us. It's more than just the news and the Free Press and AP and MERS and Gongwer, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's an entire statewide media that you have to deal with. And, you know, you'll get some of the smaller publications or news outlets up north, and to them, that one issue they're working on is the biggest thing. It might be something that doesn't get a blip here in the Capitol Press Corps, because you guys have bigger issues you're working on, but locally, that's a big issue, and you have to help them work through it. And you have to try to treat everybody equally, and you can't dismiss somebody because it's a reporter from up north and it's a smaller market. That's not how I've ever operated, and we've tried to keep that going through all the years I was there.
You've done state government work in some capacity or the other for how many years?
Well, I started in the House back in the mid-90s, okay. And I left for a couple of years to do private sector, and then came back in. So.
All right, so we're talking 20-some years.
It's hard to add it all up and think about it, but yeah, it's been a while.
Do you see yourself continuing in that in some way?
I am looking at doing some freelance writing and consulting projects. I want to work with public relations and public affairs firms really around the state. I think there's a lot of issues that I could offer some expertise to people on, and that's what I'm looking to do is try to help out on a project basis.
You're hanging out your own shingle.
I am. I'm hanging out my own shingle, and I want to see if I can be of service to people. I've got a lot of experience. I have a good skill set for that. I think after a while, you kind of learn what works and what doesn't in this town. I think it's helpful. And one of the things that is hard to deal with in the Capitol right now is sort of that lack of institutional knowledge. And I was just talking to somebody this morning about, you know, you're talking about issues that come up, and you can either look at it and say, this is how we should work this issue, and this is how it's going to resonate or not resonate. Or an issue might come up, and you'll go, really? Again? Here we go. hasn't been done yet, but we're going to try it again. So that's something that just keeps people busy.
Now, you and Jesse, your wife, are very active trekkers. Hey, explain what that is.
We are. We like to camp and hike and get outdoors, and especially in Michigan, but we'll go to other states. And so we started a website and a YouTube channel, and we're just trying to share our love for what we do in the outdoors, and particularly all around Michigan. And we're going to put that out there and see if people can get some benefit from it.
You guys put together a 2018 Where We've Been kind of thing, which was pretty cool. And so this is something you're going to continue to do?
Yeah, we are continuing to do that, and we'll continue to log our travels. And we have a project we're going to do, actually. It's going to be a statewide project in Michigan that we'll be announcing shortly. And, you know, I think that's going to be fun to do and should be of interest to people. And so, you know, we love the outdoors. We love what Michigan has to offer statewide. There's a tremendous state park network. There's a lot of off-road trails you can do. There's some great national forests in this state. So there's a lot to appreciate.
Hidden treasure in Michigan would be?
A hidden treasure in Michigan. I think sometimes people don't think about things year-round that they should. We've got a trip coming up. We're going to be going to Tequamanon Falls up in the UP here in a couple weeks. So mid-January in the winter in Tequamanon Falls, people don't realize the state park is still open. The falls are obviously always open and still there. So it's a really different time of year to be there. I think it's a great time to be there. The crowds and the mosquitoes are at a much lower level, so it's a good time to visit.
Places that you'd like to go in Michigan that you haven't gone to yet. Places on your bucket list.
I would like to see more of the UP. We've seen quite a bit of it in our travels, but there's areas, part of the problem is having the time to get up there, and we would like to see if we can make some time to do that and spend some time up in the UP and visit some of the smaller areas that people talk about and you just don't have a chance to get to. It's really unique up there. It's a beautiful area.
What about Isle Royale? You ever been there?
I have not, no.
That's is that on the list?
It is. We, Jesse and I, have both said we would like to get there. And, you know, the governor made a trip there back in 2018, and we were going through it. And Jesse's first question was, why aren't you staffing him on this trip? Because it would have been an opportunity to go there.
Yeah, why wouldn't you?
It just didn't work out for timing and for staffing needs. And so, you know, I got to do some other things that were pretty great, and that just wasn't one of them.
Did you get to go on the state airplane?
I did once, actually.
That's it?
Only once, and it was the little one. It was a really kind of a scary flight. Lieutenant Governor and I flew up to Sault Ste. Marie. We were doing something with the Sioux Locks, and we ended up, and it was a quick trip up and back. And yeah, it was interesting because I was taking an easel board. You know, we had a big graphic that we were going to put up and display while we were doing a presentation up there. And I walked into the aircraft hangar there at the airport in Lansing, and I got this giant board in my hand, and the pilot met us, and he said, are you taking that with us? I'm thinking, well, yeah, I don't usually walk around with a big easel board. And he said, well, let's go out now and see if it fits. And fits in the plane. I was a little concerned about what plane we were taking at that point. Because there's only a couple of us, it did fit. So, but it took up a good chunk of the airplane, so that was interesting.
Did it take away anybody's leg room?
No, we were able to shove it along the side. Luckily, there was no, but we were in two of the seats, and one of the seats in the back wasn't being used, and that helped because we sort of blocked out the windows on that side of the plane.
So it was you, the LG, and the easel board.
And an easel board and a pilot, yes.
Oh,
so
why
it's
was it
not
so
quite
scary?
As glamorous as it sounds when people say, oh, you get to take the state plane somewhere.
So there weren't drinks or anything being served?
No, there was nothing being served.
Why did you say it was scary?
I just, you know, I don't mind flying, but small planes in particular, you know, I'm a little prone to air sickness. And so it wasn't too bad, although the lieutenant governor did look over at one point and ask me if I was okay. So I don't know if I was turning colors at that point or what, but we got through it.
Any other closing thoughts here on your time here with the governor or going forward?
You know, I've thought about that a lot and looking back. And I think one of the things I'll take with me, and I've continued to do that now as I move ahead, is to remember sort of the governor's push for his relentless positive action. I mean, we all kind of got tired of hearing that phrase, right? But he honestly lived that, and that is his philosophy, is to be positive, to not worry about credit or blame, work with anybody and get the job done. And his positive attitude was contagious. It could be frustrating at times. You know, I told him once that the biggest thing that got in the way of me getting quote of the day more was relentless positive action.
No.
But that's just the reality of who he is and how he operates. And I would like to try to take that with me and kind of continue that in my personal and professional life as well.
Adler gets more positive.
Gets more positive. There's a headline, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we'll see if that sticks. But I think that's the, you know, that's what I'd like to see more of us do moving forward. I think the whole civility push is an important one. And if there's some way I can help out with that, I want to do that as well.
Positive tweets. I don't know if you get a lot of retweets being positive, though, Ari.
Yeah, that's the problem. You know, is it doesn't get you that attention. But it's what we needed to do. And you know, we got toward the end and we were talking about a lot of bills that were coming over and we were going to have questions or concerns about and, you know, whether we should do them or not. And I remember in a meeting one day I said, you know, as we get toward the end, maybe we should take some chances and consider a little more ruthless positive action. And it got a chuckle out of the governor, but he wasn't going there. So we stuck with being relentlessly positive.
Oh, geez, no fun. Well, it looks like you had a great time there with the governor, and looking forward to working with you. Ari Adler, leaving as the press secretary for Governor Rick Snyder, and will be more of a full-time trekker, which sounds like a lot more fun.
I think it's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to try and enjoy this state as much as we can.
All right, that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to John, Jack, Jacob, Ari, and Andrea Bitely for coming in here on short notice, even though you didn't bring the bread.
Next time. And this went well, so you'll get bread.
Okay. So, and you're also going to be baking English muffins, is that true?
That's my afternoon plan. I'll leave here. I purchased all the ingredients at our local Meijer store to make some English muffins.
Why not cookies?
I've made those.
Oh. They're not
bored,
very
difficult. Kyle, I'm bored.
So this is all about challenging yourself.
It is. It is all about challenge. Every day has to be a challenge and something new.
How do you get those little holes under the English muffins?
It's because there's something, the yeast process creates the bubbles.
Ooh, this could be very exciting.
You also fry them. Did you know that you fry English muffins before you bake them?
That'd be good.
Right?
What do you mean you fry them? Like you put them in a deep fryer?
No, you skillet like a pancake.
Really?
Yeah, the bottoms. You have to get the bottoms all golden
crispy?
Brown. Yes. And then you bake them in the oven.
I like that even better now.
I was picturing like an English muffin donut.
Oh.
So basically, no matter what in your career, you're going to make sure you've been making bread and now you're going to be making a different thing.
I'm always making something.
Wow. I think she's tempting us to bring her on next week so she can bring in the English muffins so we can taste them.
I think tomorrow.
Now, full disclosure, I'm not subject to FOIA anymore, but I will disclose this. First several loaves of bread, you didn't want to try.
Oh, okay.
You didn't want to eat.
I'm sure in the end you're going to be very good at them because you always were able to rise to the challenge of public opinion.
Yeah! All right, we better end on this pun. Until next week, thank you AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.
That the world is only what the world